Anytime you talk about the restoration movement in America, there's a great danger that I think we always have to be careful to avoid. And that is that we sometimes think that the restoration movement and what happened in this country in the late 17, early 1800s was the beginning of the church. And that's not true. Throughout history, there have always been people who aligned themselves with God, who were a part of Christianity. Sometimes they called themselves Christians. Sometimes they didn't. I had a good friend who went to Russia and was preaching in Russia. He had taken the time to learn the Russian language. Bill, having spent time over there, came back, and we were talking about the Christians in Russia. He said, for the most part, they call themselves Baptists, and it's because they baptize people. It's not that they're aligned with the Baptist church as we know it here in America, but they call themselves Baptists, and it would be very difficult to distinguish between anything that they teach or do and what he was familiar with. He was, of course, preaching in Bellingham when he developed cancer. And during his cancer treatments, that's when he took the time to learn to speak Russian. So let's never succumb to the notion that the church began with the work that was done by the Campbells and the Stones and in America in the late 1700s and early 1800s. That's just not the case. We will, as we look at this, see that there are four periods of religious awakening or religious revival in America. The first happened in between 1730 and 1755 and really kind of reached its peak around 1740. And the person that is most associated with this period of religious awakening in America is a preacher by the name of Jonathan Edwards. And we'll talk a little bit more about him as we go on. There was another period of religious awakening, the second period of religious awakening between 1790 and about 1840. This is the period that we discuss most often when we talk about the Restoration Movement in America, because this is the period that saw Barton W. Stone and Alexander and Thomas Campbell and so many of the developments that we are most concerned about in the Church of Christ or in the Christian church or in the disciples of Christ. This is the second period of religious awakening, 1790 to 1840. This is the period that we're most familiar with. There was a third period of religious awakening in 1855 to about 1930. And this reached its zenith around the time of the First World War. Then a fourth period of religious awakening in the 1960 to 1980 period. And this is the period that many of us are most affected by because, frankly, this is our period of religious awakening. So we'll discuss as we go through here each one of these periods of religious revival. And we'll sort of divide this class into four sections. What I'd like to do is discuss each period for between 8 and 10 weeks, and then take a break between periods, because we would go for, goodness, over a half a year without a break. So I think it's good for us to take a break. It lets us digest some of the material that we've been talking about, lets us think about how it's impacting us, and give us just a little bit of a break. So we'll do about 8 to 10 weeks. Then we'll take a couple of 3 weeks break between each one of these periods. As I said before, it's this second period that's most often discussed. But remember, each period sets the stage for what comes after it. And without understanding what the religious culture was like in the 1790s, it's hard to understand why what happened happened in this second period of awakening. It's very difficult to discuss any single period without having a historical context. So, any questions at this point? That will serve as a brief introduction, kind of explain to you a little bit about what I would like to do as we talk about the restoration movement in the United States, the restoration movement in America. Any questions at this point before we begin our discussion tonight? Again, remember, we're kind of using that Corinthian model. If you have something to say, just speak up, and the speaker will relinquish the floor so that you can make your comment. That's about the only way that we can do this, because I can't even put all of you on the screen at one time. So if you raise your hand, I have no idea that you have something that you would like to say. And it's hard for me to monitor the chat panel and the people panel and my outline at the same time. So help me out a little bit and just speak up. Remember, that doesn't bother me. I don't think it bothers any of our teachers. That's what we want you to do, is just go ahead and speak up. That's really what we're trying to accomplish.
Dean?
Yes.
I looked at the introduction on the first group, and you look at how strict they were and some of the things that they were requiring. Are you going to go into any of the things that they were walking away from? Because I know that the Catholic Church was probably even stronger in some of those things that they did as far as controlling people.
That's true, and that's a good point, Carol. Next week, we're going to talk about church covenants. And then the week after that, we're going to talk about halfway covenants. So you make a very good point. I'm not certain that the effort to restore or reform the Catholic Church was what really motivated most of the Christians in the United States, in America, because for the most part, America wasn't settled by Catholics. So the Catholic influence in America was not particularly strong. So there wasn't anything. And really, the Catholic influence wasn't very strong in the countries that the colonists in America came from. That's an interesting period of Reformation. And I wish that we could go all the way back and talk about the Reformation, but then this class would last for 2 years. So it is important to think about the Reformation and what was accomplished by Calvin and some of the other thinkers as they pulled away from the Catholic Church, but we're going to see the American colonists were really pulling away from the Church of England or from the Anglican Church.
Okay. My drift of thinking on that is we had a lesson on all the different people in Europe as they were breaking away from the Catholic Church, trying to reform that. And I just remember that they burned people at the stakes for having heretic views, and that they even dug them up and burned their remains and scattered them in the river so that they couldn't be worshipped so it seems to me that it's just, when I look at this first Reformation, I go, that's being nice to people. I mean,
yeah, you make a very good point.
But in historical context, I think we have to understand that the people that we're talking about in this country came from the people who reformed from that. So people who had left that and created their own in Europe, like the Church of England, the Anglican Church, the Lutherans in Germany and abroad and further out from Germany. These people came from those groups more than they came from Catholicism. Their ancestors had already left Catholicism to form these groups that now these people are fleeing from. Is that correct, Dean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Carol does make a good point. Many of the excesses,
yes,
that characterized the Catholic Church began to characterize the people who left the Anglican Church.
Yes.
Now, they never got to the selling of indulgences in order to build the great cathedrals. But you will see a lot of the things that have happened in the past repeat themselves. It's almost like you're looking at the Inquisition in some of the colonies. Of course, the Inquisition was the Catholic response to the Restoration or to the Reformation. So history repeats itself, unfortunately. History just seems to repeat itself. And I'm afraid that history is repeating itself again. So let's talk a little bit about the Christians in the colonies, the early colonialists. The religious environment in the colonies was dominated really by Christianity. There really weren't very many Catholic groups that came to America. There were some pockets of Catholicism, there, just like there were some pockets of Judaism, but the Jews and the Catholics were a distinct minority. And many times in America, they were persecuted for their faith in the same way that the Catholics had persecuted other people because of their faith. You're probably familiar with the Salem witch trials. And one of the things that was alleged about those that were supposed to be witches were that they were Catholics or Jews. And that's kind of to repeat pretty much what Carol was suggesting. There's even some evidence that the Catholics and the Jews in America were blamed for bad harvests. Some of the more incendiary writers of the colonial period did blame them. The Native American religious practices were pretty much stamped out. They were condemned as satanic by most of the people who came to this country. Now, that continued to happen even when Americans began to settle in Alaska. And I'm somewhat familiar with what was done to the Alaska natives and their religious practices when Americans sent missionaries to Alaska prior to the time that it became a state, when it was still a territory. So the natives were forced to worship in secret. They were forced to carry on their religion. And even in the case of Alaska, the natives were forced to speak their native languages in secret. Most of the native languages really almost died in the under the influence of American colonialists. Now, there was a Catholic influence that was felt more in California, but that's because California largely was settled by the Spanish, not the English. And so you had the missions that were built along the El Camino Real, the major trade route north to south in California, but that really didn't extend outside of California. Among the colonialists, atheism was not tolerated. You could not be an atheist. In fact, they would put you to death. They would just force you out of the colony. And in some cases, they actually did execute people for being atheists. There was a movement in Europe in the 1900s, called deism. It had been discussed among the intelligentsia, but deism really didn't come into vogue until the late 18th century. And so we're not going to talk a great deal about deism, but there's some feeling that Jefferson and some of the other founding fathers may have been deists, but it really wasn't very well developed.
What is deism?
Deism is the philosophy that God created the world and then stepped back and lets the world just sort of go on its way without any real involvement. And that really wasn't very popular, particularly in the colonial period. But like I say, Jefferson and perhaps Ben Franklin may have been deists. Franklin probably was influenced by the time that he spent in Europe. So let's kind of set the stage with the colonies. The colonies are really kind of divided into three parts. You have New England, then the middle colonies, and then you have the southern colonies. New England colonies were mostly founded by separatist Anglicans. They didn't want to reform the Anglican Church as much as to separate from the Anglican Church. Then there was the Puritans. The Puritans are the people that we most associate with the colonies. But the Puritans were a relatively small group. The Puritans wanted to stay Anglican, but they wanted to rid the Anglican Church of Catholic influences. So they didn't want to reform the Catholic Church. They really wanted to reform the Anglican Church. Now, both the Anglicans and the Separatists had been persecuted in England. there was a short period of time when the Catholic Church came to ascendancy, but that was really very short-lived. For the most part, the English were influenced by the Anglican Church. They were, these groups, the Separatists and the Puritans, had been persecuted in England, so they came to America largely so that they could establish a place where they could worship freely. But understand that when they came to America to establish a place where they could worship freely, that meant that you could worship freely as long as you worshiped the way that they worshiped. Now, there were a couple of exceptions. Rhode Island was an exception. That colony was quite a bit more religiously more tolerant than the other colonies. But in the colonies, if it had been established by Puritans, if you didn't adhere to Puritan beliefs, you could be exiled. And sometimes those dissenters from the prevailing belief in a colony were even hung. So they were serious about religion. It dominated everyday life. Work and leisure activities stopped on Saturday afternoon, and they didn't resume until Sunday evening. So it wasn't just work. It was leisure activities as well. Sunday had to be spent in church. And the constables in some of the towns would round up non-attenders. Now, in some cases, that was a job that was done by church deacons. But they enforced going to church. And characteristically, their services lasted all day, started Sunday morning early and lasted until sundown on Sunday. They took a short intermission for lunch, and the church would provide lunch at what they called a noon house or a Sabbath day house. These were taverns or inns, and a tavern then was really less a bar and more a place to go to get something to eat. So they would build these taverns or inns close to the meeting house, and they would go to the meeting house, spend all morning, then they would adjourn for a short break. Everybody would go to the tavern, and they would have lunch, and then they would come back to the meeting house. You could not go in the morning, go to lunch, and then go home. You could not return to your homes until services were completed. Sermons lasted between 3 and 5 hours, and you thought I was long-winded. They generally sang a cappella hymns, but because most people couldn't read, they would have one of the deacons who happened to be literate read a line of the song. Then everybody else would repeat that line of the song. Then the deacon would read the next line, kind of like that Catholic habit of leading and then responding. So that's the way that they sang. Seats in the meeting houses were assigned according to social class. And the more prominent members of the community would have seats in the front of the meeting house. And that was an important place to be because that's where the pot-bellied stove was. And if you sat in the front, you stayed warm. I remember when I was preaching in Brookings, it was a little surprising that everybody would come in and they would sit on one side of the pews only. They would sit over close to the windows. So the aisle, we only had one aisle of pews. The seats that were available on one side were cold because that's where the heater didn't blow warm air. And on the other side, that's where the heater was. So everybody sat on the side where the heater was.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, go ahead.
But to their credit, if we had a visitor come in, we moved. People moved to give up their good seats. So I want to put in a plug for the Christians in Brookings. That is true. They took those seats, but they happily gave them up when somebody would come in, when their guests would come in.
That is true. And of course, they kind of watched out for guests to come in when I was preaching in Brookings. And they would actually invite them to come and sit where it was warm. And trust me, it was cold in that building. So the wind would blow and it was miserably cold on some Sundays. Now they built a new building and it's not like that anymore. That was the little building that we refurbished in the center of town. 722 Chetco Avenue, across the street from the post office, because I did a radio program down there. If you took a seat that was assigned to somebody else, you had to pay a fine. Right? They were, not only were they serious about religion in general, they were serious about recognizing social class as a part of worship. And it reminds me, of course, of what James said. Misbehaving boys, and occasionally girls, but boys have a tendency to have a corner on the market for misbehavior. So misbehaving boys could be publicly beaten for misbehaving in church. They always wore black or very somber gray clothes on Sunday. Other days they would wear brighter colors. So they didn't wear their Sunday best every day of the week, but their Sunday best was always black or gray, very somber colors. And that was the way that they conducted themselves. The middle and the southern colonies were settled mostly by Anglicans and Quakers. We don't hear as much about the middle and southern colonies because they were quite a bit more sparsely populated. The population centers in the colonies were really in the north, in New England. In Maryland, the founders were Catholics, and some of them were nonconformist Protestants. But like I say, there were small pockets of Catholics and Jews, but not prominently. In the South, strict religious laws were less common than they were in New England. But the Quakers did impose their views on the legal code, which sort of reminds me of the existence of Sharia law. You know, you can live in Afghanistan. You don't have to be Muslim to live in Afghanistan, but because the Muslims infused their religious beliefs into Sharia law, it's just about the same thing as saying you have to be a Muslim to live in Afghanistan. Quaker Pennsylvania was the first colony that condemned slavery and the mistreatment of natives. In fact, Pennsylvania was the first colony to pass a law mandating religious toleration. Now, Pennsylvania, remember, is one of the middle colonies. It's not the South. The Quaker meeting houses were distinct. They were used not just as religious meeting houses, but they were, in many senses, the only public building in a particular village. Now, this was something that happened when I was living in Alaska, and missionaries would go to the various native villages, and particularly those native villages of 100 to maybe 200 total population. And they would, with the backing of a particular religious group in the lower 48, build a meeting house in each village. So each village had one meeting house. The village of Point Hope, for instance, was a Presbyterian village. There was a Presbyterian church in the town. Now, the Presbyterian church also served as the town jail. It was the hospital, such as it was. It was the meeting hall. It was where the only radio phone was in the entire village. So these meeting houses that the Quakers built were a lot more than just a religious meeting house. Interestingly, the stocks, and you're familiar with stocks, that's where you had to put your head and your feet and your hands through a split wooden post or split wooden board. And that was where you were publicly shamed. The stocks were usually located at the Quaker meeting houses. The Quakers, for the most part, did not paint their meeting houses. They left them very plain. And that's because if you painted it, that was just a show of vanity. And that may have been a response to everything that was going on in Europe and England with the building of the great cathedrals, and may have been a response to that. But the Quakers took this notion of vanity very seriously. The Quakers at one time divided over whether a man should wear two suspenders or whether just one had to be worn, because one was sufficient to hold up your pants, two was just vanity. So they were serious about this notion of vanity. I found this description of a Quaker meeting house. Churches were all unheated. Few had stoves until the middle of the 19th century. The chill of the damp buildings, never heated from autumn to spring and closed and dark through the week, was hard for everyone to bear. In some of the early log-built meeting houses, fur bags made of wolf skins were nailed to the seats. And in winter, church attendants would put their feet into them. Dogs were permitted to enter the meeting house and lie on their master's feet. Dog whippers or dog pelters were appointed to control the dogs and expel them when they became unruly or unbearable. So their meeting houses must have been very, very different than anything that we are familiar with. In Virginia, they were so serious about keeping religious observances that there grew up a group called the Cavaliers. That's interesting that the Cavaliers are the school mascot for the University of Virginia. Anyway, the Virginia Cavaliers were a group of self-appointed Sunday keepers. They enforced the rules in Virginia relative to conduct on Sunday. No work, no leisure activities. Everyone was supposed to remain in church except for the allowed intermission for lunch all day. So not only was religious observation a part determined by individual conscience, it was actually enforced, which in some ways reminds me of what happened in old Israel when you had the theocracy and King David said, we're going to have a Sabbath on this day and you will worship, whether you really wanted to or not, you will worship. Sir Thomas Dale arrived in Virginia in 1611. He established rules for discipline and rules for the colony and declared that failure to attend church should be punishable by death. But none of the historians that I was able to read could find any evidence that that policy was ever enacted in Virginia. The Anglican Church came from England and dominated in Virginia. In 1750, a large group of Baptists migrated to that area. When they arrived, they were frequently arrested, they were harassed, they were beaten, and they were cordially invited to go somewhere else. So, although the colonies were founded on the principle of religious freedom, it was not religious tolerance. In fact, it was religious intolerance. Maryland was originally founded by the Catholics. They observed Mass on Sunday, but it didn't last all day long. And because their Mass didn't last all day long, the Puritans, the Anglicans, thought that they, and the Quakers, thought that they weren't religious. Protestant colonists migrated from New England and the Middle Colonies into Maryland. Eventually, they ousted the Catholics. They deported the Jesuits and other Catholic priests. And by 1646, they had remade the colony of Maryland in their own image. And after that, Anglican Protestantism dominated in Maryland as well. So what I want you to see from this is an understanding of homogeneity versus variety. Even though large areas claimed allegiance to a single denomination, there was still variation between the colonies of the same denomination. So you had Quakers in one place, and they were different than Quakers in another place. The Puritans in Boston were not the same as the Puritans in the Plymouth colony. And both of them differed from the Puritans that you would have found if you went to the Salem settlement. So, religion dominated everyday life in the colonies. You could not do business for the most part. You could not conduct social affairs without being a part of the recognized religion. And there was no question that that was the case. So next week we'll talk a little bit about church covenants. And the covenant that you're probably most familiar with is the Mayflower Compact. That was a church covenant. It was also a covenant that regulated the relationships between the colonists outside of the church, but it began as a church covenant. So we'll talk about that and why that's important to the development of the first Great Awakening. So any questions up to this point? I think most of us are familiar with what we've been talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
Who was ahead of all of this that was going on in these different religions?
I'm sorry, say that again.
She said, who was the head? But wasn't the head just the individual leader of each colony?
Yes. Yeah, there was no single titular head over all of the colonies.
Dean?
Yes.
Isn't one of the problems, which is why things were so harsh and so hard ruled, is that the leaders who became the leaders had uneducated people who could not read God's word, so that they were, even though they had good intention, they could control them more as to what their interpretation or what they thought about religion was.
Well, of course, that's a good point. Anytime you have a group, whether it's the priests, the preachers, the leadership of the denomination, anytime you have a particular group that can control access to biblical information, then you will get this kind of religious intolerance and enforced religious conformity, especially if they have the power of the civil government behind them. I just got a chance to go back and look. Who is DMLEU? I don't recognize that name.
That's Di Lindsay.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's Di.
Okay. Well, thank you guys. Next week, church covenants. Then the week after that, halfway covenants. And then we'll start talking a little bit about the restoration that happened as those things sort of emerged. And Jonathan Edwards is one of the leaders who emerged during this first Great Awakening. And he preached a very famous sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. If you'd like to read that sermon, just Google Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And you can find that in a number of different places on the internet. That sermon sort of sets the stage for understanding the way that they were trying to reform what was going on with the halfway covenants.